me tell you of the days of high adventure.
I'm John.
And I'm Kevin.
And this is 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, the podcast where we take a long, hard look at some of our favorite action movies from the era of Arnold.
Schwarzenegger is the icon of the genre, and we're taking a deep dive into some of these 80s and 90s cult action movies and breaking them all the way down.
We're going to get into the nitty and the gritty and examine the good, the bad, the ugly, and the laughable in these movies.
But we're always coming from a place of love. You don't watch these movies as much as we have unless you have a genuine affection for them.
Kevin, we meet again.
Yes, this is, we're stepping outside of our normal zone because we're talking about a movie that neither one of us had ever grown up watching or seen before.
We have done what we call the blind taste test several times.
But now this is a double blind.
Double blind.
But we have a wise sage. We have a guide to help us through this. Our most prominent guest, recurring guest,
fan.
Andrew is with us. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, and loyal fan is probably more accurate than prominent. Maybe frequent.
You are most prominent expert outside expert opinions.
Yeah. I couldn't believe that you guys hadn't seen this movie. Right in there. It is 1986's Highlander.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was thinking long and hard about this, and I would have been, 4 years old when this movie was made. And so it makes sense that, this fell out of my wheelhouse. I don't think it was on as heavy a rotation on TBS and some other things for some reason, but I just never, it's in the zeitgeist. It's been my whole life.
It's in the ether.
There can be only one, is like a thing that you grow up knowing about, but I just never seen the movie.
Yeah, it's wild. See, I was only one. So my story of watching it was some friends of my parents. They lived out of town, and so sometimes they would come into town, they'd bring their kids with them, and then we'd have to have forced, awkward social situations with their children. Who were fine. They were cool, but it's like meeting a new kid and on day one being like, all right, I guess we play together now.
but he had access to their VHS collection.
Well, his dad, they were at our house, and his dad went to Blockbuster, rented it, and brought it to our house and was like, we're watching this. And I was maybe, 9 or 10. So I wasn't old enough to be watching a hard R movie that my parents had never seen before.
That's crazy.
But
it
ruled.
Brazen of that guy.
That's a brazen guest move.
And then I was thinking that had I seen this movie at the age of 9 or 10, it would have been one that I would have been obsessed with.
Oh, absolutely, dude. Sword fighting, different type, medieval swords and samurai. It's been rad.
Watching it this time, I had the first first feeling that I should have thought of years ago, but this feels like Star Wars in the Terminator universe.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Yes.
Totally.
There's a lot of shades of both of those movies in this, especially the more repeat watches going through. I'm just like, wow, they did lift a lot of Star Wars type mythos.
Yeah,
totally.
For this thing. But and the dude was just a Terminator knockoff, the Kurgan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's gritty New York. It has the universe of Terminator. It feels like that first movie. But at the same time, they're Jedis running around sword fighting. They can't kill each other human beings in the 80s.
Lots of really, really interesting sci-fi elements from lots of different things. And then other things that show up in other movies, a weird Top Gun-esque sex scenes and whatnot.
So. Yeah. Weirdly timed sex scenes too. They're oh boy, we're in his crosshairs. But Terminator had that same sex scene, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and it's got that same day for night look that Top Gun has. I totally know that it has that blue coloring over it where they were in full light, this sex scene is maybe a little too much for the R. So we're going into blue.
Yeah, there were nips. There were boobies.
Yeah.
but anyway, I guess we should let's talk about some of the folks behind the film.
Absolutely.
So do you want to dive into that shite?
Yeah. Directed by a dude named Russell Mulcahy.
Never heard of him.
Nah, me neither. I mean, he directed this and the sequel to this. He directed The Shadow.
Oh, that's
a girl watching The Shadow. That was the one
with Baldwin.
The Shadow or The Phantom?
The Phantom was Billy Zane.
Okay, and The Shadow was Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
I watched that shit. And he directed a ton of music videos.
That makes sense, because it seems like in reading the production list, like all the personnel, you get a lot of people who fucking hung their whole careers around this franchise.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he directed the second one, which is interesting because that is by far, as much as I love this movie, that is by far the worst film I've ever seen in my entire life.
I thought you were going to say maybe that it was better than this.
Oh, no, no, no.
I thought you were too. you teased me.
Highlander 2, The Quickening, tries to retcon some of the things that are like plot holes maybe of this, but in a way that destroys everything. And really, the big thing is that they're trying to protect Earth from a hole in the ozone layer. So it's got that it's got that weird Star Trek thing where they like try to go back in time to save the whales. Like, it's a failure in every imaginable way.
Oof, that is rough. That is rough.
And despite the Mulcahy sort of sounding like a Scottish name to me, he's like an Australian dude, apparently. Yeah. But whatever.
Well, he may have Scottish roots, though.
Absolutely. His parents were, or grandparents, notorious criminals.
That's right.
written, the story and the main writer was this guy named Gregory Wyden. It was also written by a dude named Peter Bellwood and another guy named Larry Ferguson.
Yeah, right. That Wyden, he's one of those that has milked this franchise for all
didn't
of,
do a
all
lot,
it's worth.
Probably gotten a lot of this, but he did write Backdraft.
Yeah, which I his cap there.
I love Backdraft.
Yeah, that movie's good.
I haven't thought about that movie in a while, but I love that movie. And then I saw the dude Bellwood, he wrote the sequel, like the screenplay for the sequel, and really nothing else.
Right.
But the guy Larry Ferguson,
he was busy. He was doing good shit.
He did Beverly Hills Cop 2, Hunt for Red October.
Solid.
Alien 3. Like, so at least he was making big studio flicks.
And some quality
writing
stuff.
Writing them, yeah. Music by Michael Kamen.
Always quality.
He's come up on this podcast many times. He's like the action movie guy.
But also, music by who else?
By one of my favorite bands growing up, Queen.
Yeah, dude. I remember in college you were loving the Queen's Greatest Hits albums and all that shit.
Loved it.
Fat Bottom Girls.
Yes.
You're sitting bicycle.
Yes.
I want to ride by.
Feelings on Queen are mixed, but
well, and it's understandable. Like as an adult with an objective viewpoint on musical quality, you can go back and listen. Like even the album Night at the Opera is just full of questionable songs. It's like, what the hell is happening?
It was like a amazing singer in a band that had a handful of really good songs and then a whole lot of songs that were just like, ugh.
Well, I think it was one of those, they were trying to be democratic. It was like, everybody's allowed to write a song and regardless of whether it's any good, we got to fill up this album. So some of the stuff that like Brian May for being as like one of the great guitar gods and still just slaying worlds like right now, just wrote some really, really weird and shitty songs.
Yeah.
Were you a Queen guy, Andrew?
Yeah, I was. And I agree 100% with that take. Like Roger Taylor's I'm in Love with My Car. Like
the worst song ever.
Yeah. Like there are some bands that like, you know, we're all going to participate equally. And that's just not the way that things should be done. Like Roger Taylor, you're the drummer.
Yeah. Sit up there, play the drums guy. Yeah.
Even like Bohemian Rhapsody, right? Amazing song. But it also was just, we're going to throw a bunch of ideas at the wall on this one. And so we're going to see what works. Because it could have just as easily been a disaster.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that they're one of those bands that I feel like, you know, Duran Duran falls in the same category for me where they're 100% on and those songs got released as singles and then they needed 12 other songs to go on that album.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. Well, see, Queen in the streaming era would thrive. They would kill it because it's like we don't need a full album. You put a song out and it gets 10 million, you know, downloads and
yeah.
That's the thing.
And they had like those arena songs, like the arena rock songs, you know, the stadium songs.
Big time. So yeah, Michael Kamen, always
back
quality.
To, circling back
and,
to Kamen.
And Queen.
But yeah, Kamen was like the dude who did Die Hard and Lethal Weapon. And
Robin
like
Hood,
a bunch
Prince
of
Thieves.
Yes. Roadhouse.
One of your favorites, Open Range, I didn't realize he wrote the music for. But yeah. He also did the that iconic, all the iconic music from the series Band of Brothers.
Yeah, he's great. Ooh, I think he's nice. Passed away. I believe that came up when we were doing Roadhouse.
Yeah.
I think he passed away.
I forget. I get too drunk and I forget.
Don't usually shout out to the editor, but I want to on this one because there's some really weird edits in this movie. Like some really weird edits.
Man, but
the editor was this guy named Peter Honus. And he has had a storied career. Aside from this, he edited LA Confidential.
Oh,
amazing movie.
Yeah. Great movie.
He also edited the original The Fast and the Furious, which is like such a far cry from LA Confidential.
That was 30 years ago.
He did Rob Roy and he did Troy.
Rob Roy is one of the great movies.
He's done some big epic movies and some
weird ones.
Yeah, some exploitation type movies and weird B action flicks.
You know, as many weird edits as there are in this movie, though, there are some really great transitions, too, especially as they travel through time.
Agreed. The jumps, the transitions through time. I would say all but one of them nail it. And then there's one that's like a fucking PowerPoint presentation bullshit that I was like, I paused it and I think I literally said out loud, what the fuck?
The old George Lucas wipe.
No, we'll get to that transition later. But we should talk about who's in this
movie.
Who's
in this flick? Starring Christopher Lambert.
Raiden from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, that was my only knowledge of him before this, and I knew that he was Highlander.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was Tarzan in like that 80s Tarzan movie.
That movie was chocked full of like A-listers.
I feel like I don't know who directed it, but I feel like it was probably some big fucking deal who directed that.
Yeah.
Because it was, I think it was meant to be like a big prestige movie, and I don't think it was actually very good.
Because it
was
starring Christopher Lambert.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the dude's not really an actor, if you ask me. I don't know.
No.
I don't know how he's good for him that he's made a career for himself on a meager talent.
What I found the most confusing is this is a movie about a Scottish man. It has a Scottish man in it. And that Scottish man does not play the Scot in the film. A Frenchman plays the Scot in the film.
He plays I read that. Lambert was born in Little Neck.
Born in America.
And then his dad was an ambassador to Switzerland.
His dad was like a Frenchman. His parents were French, like diplomats.
And so definitely grew up speaking French. Probably also spoke German. Definitely not Scottish.
Definitely not. Yeah, not. Apparently, did you see he didn't even like speak English, barely spoke English when he got this part. He had to learn English. How do you cast him for that?
I don't know, but
there were other Scots that you could have.
That's Arnold's
cast.
Whole story, though. So
yeah, that's true.
It works in this situation. It's your podcast, English as a second language.
Well,
the film.
See, so I assumed that he was like had some before I saw the movie, I should say. I assumed that Lambert must be like a martial artist from the Van Damme mold or the Schwarzenegger mold, like someone who's got some talent that not everyone has, and like the accent and the struggle to act is his handicap. But no, he doesn't know martial arts either.
He doesn't know.
And he's not much of an actor.
My whole thing was that somebody made some phone calls and were trying to like further this guy's career. Like
he got pushed to the top of the list.
He was one of those people that they're like, this guy should be famous.
I don't know why. I don't even get charisma from him, really.
No, nothing. Get nothing from him. But we'll talk more about that.
I mean,
who else is in it?
At least in this movie, he plays someone from the same continent that he is from. In Mortal Kombat, he's supposed to be an Asian, like, lightning god. So at least in this one, it's like, all right, it's only in, like, I don't know, 500 miles, close enough.
Yeah
even in my pre-liberal swing, like, as a middle schooler watching Mortal Kombat, I was like, wait a minute, isn't he supposed to be, I don't know, vaguely Asian?
The fact that they would get him in Mortal Kombat and like think he was like the big name attached to that movie. And it's like, that was what made me think this dude must have been a martial artist. And like, he brings some martial arts cred to the Mortal Kombat movie with all these other people we haven't ever heard of. But no, he was just Highlander. I guess they're like, can you believe we got Highlander?
The pitch was Mortal Kombat's going to have a lot of blue lightning.
Yeah.
So we need Christopher Lambert. We need
someone who's comfortable working with Blue Lightning.
Who's got experience with Blue Lightning? Oh, I got a guy.
I know just the fella.
I mean, his lack of Taekwondo or any other martial arts skill explains why Raiden does fuck all in that movie also. Yeah. He just kind of sits around and appears.
He's like, I'm not allowed to participate except for the moments that I participate.
I just sit back and I'm kind of like the guru or something. I'm the sensei for you guys.
What supposed to be
I
your
coach. I give you guys some pep talks.
Who else is in this movie?
Well, we've talked about it a little bit. The complete opposite.
Yeah.
We got someone with charisma and like just appeal for days. Sean Connery, the man, rest in peace.
Yeah. Just this one of the all time swoon worthy stars of the big
natural
screen.
Natural performer, natural talent. Yeah, he's awesome. He's done it all.
Yeah.
We could spend a whole podcast just talking about his credits.
Yeah.
But yeah, Connery's fucking killer. Clancy Brown, young Clancy Brown.
Very young.
Byron Hadley.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
One of the most terrifying characters ever.
Yeah, we were talking about the evil prison guard from Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. It turns out not to be that evil in the end.
Right.
Right.
Pussy.
He was in Starship Troopers.
He's been busy with Star Wars stuff of late. We've talked about him.
Voice acting?
Yeah, well, he's done voice acting. He did the voice of the character Ryder Azadi in the Rebels series, and he had a bit part in, I think it was a couple episodes, recurring role in Mandalorian.
And I only, this was just kismet that I found this out. I didn't realize that he is the voice of Mr. Krabs in SpongeBob.
Ooh. I saw that on IMDb that he'd done it, but I didn't know he was on the series.
He's the guy. He is he's Mr. Krabs from day one.
That's awesome.
That's amazing to me. Yeah. What a great voice that is that he does for that character.
He is one of the saving graces of this movie, and we'll talk more about it, but it's
he carries it.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about villains enjoying being the villain, and man, he just laps it up from scene one.
And then we have an actress, Roxanne Hart, playing the character of Brenda,
mm-hmm.
who didn't have a whole lot else in her career that jumped out at me. She works a lot, does a lot of just TV stuff. But yeah, there was no actresses that really did a whole lot other than be in this movie
as
far as a career. Also, we should mention there's multiple versions of this movie floating around out there.
Right.
I watched and took notes on the unrated version, I guess. Is that the one did you end up watching that
once, one? Once I started messaging back and forth saying there's something wrong, because the version on HBO, I guess, was maybe the theatrical release or an edited version, an approved edited version. But when I was comparing it to your notes, I was like, oh, shit, something's wrong. And so I was at first thinking it'd be really interesting just to do I'll do my notes on this version, and then we could compare notes. But then I was like, that's going to be such a fucking hassle. So I switched over to the version that's on Amazon for free,
which I think is the director's cut, or also known as the unrated version.
You see nipples version.
You see a little bit of nipples. You get some more violence maybe, and some weirdness, some generic weirdness that's not in the other version.
Yeah, the director's cut is the version that I have, and it's the only one that I remember. So I may have seen the theatrical cut that first time, but I've watched the director's cut so many times since then that's the version that makes sense to me.
Okay,
cool. There's only five extra minutes, and when you, Kevin, reached out to me to say, what version are you watching? And I responded with, there can't have been too much extra on the cutting
room
floor.
There can be only one.
There's the director's cut. When I saw that on the first version, I was like, well, what the hell did I get into? And then I watched it. I was this is just the regular cut. Apparently the director liked it and they rebatched it.
there was some shit that was in here that had me thinking they were scraping the bottom of every frame of film they had to stitch the story together.
Which, again, I would love to know. I wish that it was required of the film industry for them to keep a captain's log of every day, to be you would not believe the shit that happened today. so that for our benefit, we could go back and say, what? Why? I also want to just shout out two more people that are in this because I love them.
Well, do it.
One person is apparently in the movie, but having watched the movie now, I never saw him or recognized him.
Okay.
That is Christopher Malcolm playing a character named Kurt Matunas. Oh, shit. He's the vigilante guy at the end of the movie.
What else does he do?
He was Echo Base, this is Rogue 2. I found them. Repeat, I found them.
Oh, man, he looks so different. I never would have put that together.
I'm sitting here right now, and I'm like, Matunas, who's Matunas? And I was like, holy shit, it's the guy that like shot the dude up at the end of the movie.
He looked a little the worse for wear.
Yeah, he looked more svelte, I guess, because he wasn't wearing like all the pilot's get-up and stuff. But anyway, so Christopher Malcolm as the vigilante dude from the like second-to-last act of the movie, that's Rogue 2 from Empire Strikes Back. And then also the amazing James Cosmo, who, if you can't get any other like the Brian Gleesons of the world, he's Irish, but if you can't get any of those other guys, like he's the guy, like Angus, he plays Angus MacLeod, like the cousin. So
I did. He was William Wallace's sort of surrogate father in Braveheart, his best friend's dad.
Yeah,
who I think he was raised with. He was also somebody in Game of Thrones. Was it Mormont or something? Someone up on the wall.
He was a Jorah's dad.
Okay. Yeah. Mormont.
Yeah.
So good for him that he's still working. Yeah. He's iconic.
He's hell yeah. He's killing it.
Fucking love a good Scotsman.
Yeah, man.
Shout out Brian Cox.
No shout out Christopher Lambert.
Yeah, no. We do not shout you out. Oh, man. We're going to get into some Kevin Costner level accent discussions.
There's weird shit happening. Okay.
All right.
We'll get to it. So the movie opens a little studio canal animation and then followed by Canon Films, which you said was not on the theatrical.
Yeah. So on the HBO version, it's a 20th Century Fox animation, that classic animation. And then it's followed by, something else, but not, I think it just goes right into the movie. No, it just says that it's a production of whoever they're producing.
So maybe Canon had like the international rights or the home video rights or something, and they own the director's cut version distribution or something like that. I don't know, but there's no sign of Golan or Globus's names on the credits. So I think they were just distributors, not like.
I mean, there's no printed text that has their names, but their fingerprints are all over this.
Yeah. With the only exception being that we only get like some very mild product placement here and there.
There was no Pepsi or Energizer in medieval Scotland on the movie,
which is a real damn shame.
Which would have been the case if you had Stallone playing the Highlander.
I'd watch that. Yeah.
I would too.
Oh, hell yes.
It'd be amazing.
It opens, the movie opens with a little Sean Connery voiceover. I won't try to do the impression, but if anyone else has a great Connery.
From the dawn of time we came, moving silently down through the centuries, leaving many secret lives. Struggling to reach the time of the gathering, when the few who remain will battle to the last. No one has ever known we were among you until now.
Awesome. Thank you, John. Yeah, so a flaw for me right off the bat is that these immortals, like, they don't have a name for their kind.
Right.
They're just like, they never call themselves anything.
No.
Really.
Yeah.
They'll mention that they are immortal, but they're not like, they could even just say we're the immortals or something. Say, give me something.
So I think that's the one big plot hole, and I want to get to that in a second because it's later. But the other thing is, I don't think any movie that starts with a prologue, direct like speech, is off to a good start.
No,
you guys have some exposition right off the top.
Yeah, but also it's like, yeah, we're setting up whoever these quote unquote immortals are, but it's like that's basically as much information as we ever get about them, except for like. The only manner by which they can die. But then there's so many plot holes around like, well, what does it mean to be an immortal? Like,
right. They've all existed from the dawn of time or something, but that's not the case.
It's very clear that they're being born at certain points.
Yeah.
And I think that's the plot hole.
Have either of you ever read or heard of, you may have heard just from talking to me, but the Dark is Rising sequence by the author Susan Cooper.
Ooh, no.
Have either of you ever heard of that? So it is, she was an author and playwright, I believe, who married Hume Cronin after Jessica Tandy died. They got married like late in life, but she was a talented author, and she wrote this series of books that was like, it was sort of like young adult fantasy, but based around Arthurian legend. And in those books, she presents this concept of like it's light versus dark, and the dark are only ever referred to as the dark, but the old ones, who are the guardians of the light, that's like they're called the old ones. So when I was watching this, I was like, well, that just sounds like the old ones. And then you have the dark, but it's like, at least call them something.
Call them something.
Give them a name.
Call them Jedis and Siths. Call them something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're off to a rip roaring start here.
Oh yeah.
Queens Princes of the Universe blasts over the opening credits, and that Queen hits hard, man.
It does. Like,
that song was a fucking banger.
Yeah.
I liked that one.
And the songs on the soundtrack, for the most part, there's some that don't, because there are a couple ballads that are like, eh. But like the ones that rock, they rock hard. They're like, they're dark for Queen.
It was kind of like more metal than we're used to for Queen. But I think they were written like original songs for this movie for the most part, right?
Yeah, it feels a lot like this is a comparison that doesn't belong here, but Simon and Garfunkel doing The Graduate.
yes.
Cat Stevens on Harold and Maude.
Yeah, this is their like Graduate or Harold and Maude, where they're like, all right. Yeah, we're into this.
This would have been shortly after around the time that they reconciled. So they were probably like, we need to be like making as much paper as we can now that we're a united group. And they were like, we're going to stop releasing songs as individuals and only release songs as the band Queen.
So if these were all songs written around 84, 85 or something, that was like before Freddie got sick.
Right.
Right. But. Yeah, I was just like, in my mind,
maybe it was before even that, what I was just talking about.
I don't know. But in my mind, I was just like thinking Queen had already sort of come and gone by the like late 80s. But I didn't realize
when was Flash Gordon?
I think it was
81. I think it was like 80 or 81.
All the tracks of this made up their next record. It's a Kind of Magic, which definitely influenced because they say that line a couple times.
Boosting record sales.
So the action of the movie, it picks up in Madison Square Garden, where the fabulous Freebirds, hailing from Bad Street, USA in Atlanta, Georgia, are entering the wrestling ring.
They are wearing the gayest stars and bars that has ever existed.
The fucking sequined Confederate flag cape.
It was like some Confederate drag queen type stuff.
Yeah. The gay part is the awesome part.
Yeah.
I want to give a shout out also to a friend of the podcast, dearly departed Rick Hulsey, who used to call his apartment Bad Street USA.
That's awesome.
He was a big Freebirds fan. So, and shout out to Old School Wrestling.
Yeah, three guys with a combined weight of 745 pounds.
Lots of bullshit. A lot of bleached mullets.
The
fans
dude's
were
like,
fucking loving the raw sexuality.
The headbutting of the turnbuckle.
Yes, dude. Yeah. There was a creepy edit where like dude was sort of sexy removing his robe, and they showed this young child girl licking her lips as the dude was disrobing. Like fucking, that's the first of many times I'm gonna call out the editor, Peter Honus, God rest his soul. I don't know that he's dead, but there's
he's
this,
dead to me. Oh, I'm just kidding.
There was a crazy impressive like crane shot that sweeped through the whole arena.
Oh yeah.
I don't quite know how they did that shot.
They said on Amazon, the details said that was a shot that was rigged up where it was sort of like what they do now in NFL games where they've got the camera rigged up on a cable. And so they had the camera rigged up on four cables and were basically like zip lining it through the stadium and then having it turn somehow as it was coming around.
It was
for
fucking
that shot.
A killer shot.
But then it zoomed back up. I was like, that is crazy.
I was like, I don't know how you did this. I'm impressed.
Yeah, it was really awesome.
So that shot, sweeps through the whole arena, takes us over to where Connor McLeod, that's Christopher Lambert, is seated. He's got very little interest in the action in the ring.
Yeah. He's the most unhappy that anyone has ever been at a wrestling match. Like he paid to be there. Like he could have just waited in the parking garage.
So I read that apparently they originally wanted this to be an NHL match, but that the NHL, when they found out that they just wanted it to be something violent that was triggering PTSD, were like, no, thank you. We don't want to be a part of that.
Oh, yeah, okay, NHL. So, yeah, as the fans are rooting on all the violence in the ring, McLeod, as we mentioned, seems like he's having some sort of a PTSD episode. I will tell you, as a viewer that was coming into this movie cold, the chances that I thought I'd get to see some vintage pro wrestling action in this movie were close to zero.
I was shocked to see the Freebirds. Holy shit.
There was this Dom DeLuise looking motherfucker like yelling in McLeod's ear, saying, "You gotta love it!" Just yelling in his face. Oh my God. Then it cuts to medieval Scotland, of course.
Naturally.
The next, where there's like a Braveheart style battle raging. I did read where apparently all these extras that they had for the battle scenes were like university students.
That's
wherever
cool.
In Scotland, they were all fucking shit house drunk. while they were filming. Like they were hammered just to stay warm.
That's awesome.
That's amazing. So,
I love that. Now back in the arena, McCloud, he gets up out of his seat, leaves.
He whips around like something's gotten his attention, but we can't really like he sensed something, but something, we don't know why.
Yeah. So I just like you said, why did he even come here?
So we
now
know
he's going solo to a pro wrestling event just to freak out and leave.
We know too what's about to happen. He's sitting in a hard chair wearing a trench coat with a katana inside of it.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I did. Like,
yeah. This was the era where you could take a full fucking samurai sword into a sports arena.
Well, that, and like how that's comfortable. Like, how do you even sit down with a straight 4 feet long piece of metal into an arena chair?
It would have been awesome if he was sitting like how you do sometimes where you sit on the chair while it's like folded up and you kind of sit on it so the sword can go down.
One stiff leg.
So the sword can go down between the seat.
Oh my God.
This may be a hot take though. I love McCloud's style. Like
you liked it? I was wondering.
Man. Oh man. I thought, his preppy skinny jeans and that kick ass trench coat.
If he was wearing anything other than white sneakers. Ooh, I would have been I was on board, but
dirty white sneakers.
He wears those fucking white sneakers the whole movie, and I was like, you dork, like especially at the end of the movie where he goes to the last battle, and we'll get to this too, but he's wearing the same white sneaks, and I'm like, man, come on. I mean, it must be like lucky
classic,
or something.
Those are like classic Stan Smiths or something though. They're
maybe.
But yeah, he goes down, he leaves, he goes down to this desolate parking garage, seems to sense that something is amiss.
Do you see how many kick-ass cars were in that? First
I was thinking
moment.
The same. Like, the place is
that
full
Mustang
of, like,
was fucking killer. The gold Mustang. The
there's
fucking,
a T-Bird in there.
Utah.
Like it's like a bright right.
The red one.
Yeah, I think it's.
Dude.
It was amazing.
It was sweet. That was in my notes too. But I was like, I don't know if anyone else caught on to that. But dude, that's rad. They make a big deal of him stepping on a soda can for some reason.
Well, it sounds like he hears the sound of the soda can and he's like, what's that? And he's like, oh shit, never mind. I stepped on it.
Yeah.
Fucking moron. Like, what?
So now he walks slowly over to his car. This dude who looks like a clone of Michael Caine jumps out, calls him by his name, Connor McCloud.
Where the fuck does he come from? He just pops out of nowhere. We see the shot right before that showing that pillar and then he just appears.
Yeah. But I guess we'll see, right? Very skilled immortals seem to be able to disappear and appear like quickly or something.
We will never know what the extent of their powers are. Not one time in this movie will it become clear what they're capable of at all. Nothing will become clear.
I can appear and disappear, but I'm going to definitely step on this fucking Coke can in the middle of the party.
We get into the thing. It's like sometimes you can sense someone, but other times they can be right next to you and you won't know they're there. It doesn't make any sense at all.
So this dude is facile, and facile had an interesting look to me. He had like the tailored suit and the mirrored aviators.
Yeah.
I thought he looked cool. I thought, I thought McCloud just looks kind of like a schlub.
Yeah,
who wears jeans with a trench coat?
And the sneaks.
But this dude, I thought like, oh, he's just some guy. But he's like, his name's Peter Diamond. He's a fucking legendary stuntman. He was the stunt coordinator for this movie. But he was in all the original Star Wars movies and Raiders of the Lost Ark and James Bond movies.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
He was the stunt coordinator, I think, for all the Star Wars movies, the original trilogy. Fucking guys. So he's a legend of a British film.
Yeah, I love it. But like McCloud. And McCloud turns around and is like,
wait.
Facile. Wait.
Wait for what? Facile, at that moment, he produces this gilded sword from his overcoat and swings it at McCloud. McCloud dodges the swings. He draws a fucking full katana out of his trench coat.
Oh, shit. That's where you keep your swords. That's like in your trench coat.
Why give each other the heads up? Like,
no, I don't know.
He had
like, jump out and stab him.
If the goal is to chop his head off. Chop his head off. He's not there. Like, make him be ready.
So, and we're going to talk about this a lot, but this will be the first time that I'll mention it in that in a world where you know that the only way you can kill your opponent is to chop their head off. There's an awful lot of attempts to stab people, to vaguely maim people. No one is out to, I'm like, chop that dude's fucking arm off. Like, cause we know they can be hurt, incapacitate them and then execute them. But it's like, people are like, I'm going to stab you. I'm going to stab you. It's like, you've been doing this for centuries and you've learned nothing. Anyway,
Yeah, the two men, they circle each other for a moment and they go at it. Sparks are flying like crazy when they're hitting each other and hitting the cars and stuff. So we gather there's something supernatural going on here. McCloud, he loses track of Fazzle, who then pops out and hacks at an electrical conduit box thing, which causes all the fluorescent lights in there to start just flashing intermittently, because that's how that shit works.
Yeah, they're all connected. Exactly.
It's the same fucking phenomenon we mentioned in Cobra, where it's like in movies, if you shoot something or smash something that's working or not working,
it'll
all
cash,
of a sudden start working or stop working or work in a way that looks cool for filming.
Yeah, right. It's like the scene in Tango and Cash in a parking garage where you're driving through a tunnel of lights somehow. They're all like hanging down.
Or any Star Wars thing. Let me just pick up this rock and throw it at the blast door panel and it'll make the door close.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know.
Yeah, of course.
It always works. Now, Fazzle, he pops out again. They cross swords. Fazzle knocks McCloud down, and then he runs away.
Yeah.
What?
Why?
Why
would you get the upper hand and run away? I don't know. McCloud runs after him. They're running across the hood of cars. They trade some more blows. McCloud goes for the kill, but he hits one of those famous parking garage steam pipes.
Yep. Every pipe in there is full of steam.
The Madison Square Garden parking garage is dangerous.
Yeah. So then Fazzle, he sets his sword down. Does a backflip off the hood
what
of the car,
the hell?
Picks the sword up and runs off. It's like the choreography of this fight was fucking terrible, dude.
The first of many.
It seems like, first of all, I thought like, oh God, well, so neither of these guys knows the first thing about sword fighting. But that
clearly,
the stunt coordinator, this should be like something that he's done for decades.
Yeah.
Maybe, I have no clue, but the fire, the sprinklers, they start going off. It's raining water. They fight on. Fazzle disarms McCloud, but then gives him time to like pick up some sort of firefighting tool. I don't know what that was.
All right, so I read in a lot of whatever the place where you keep the hose and the axe and everything, they'll have what's called a forced entry tool, and there are many different kinds of forced entry tools. And so this might be something that's just
to bust a window out or
just
something.
Just there to bust windows out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's
it's
sort of
a
what
thing.
It looks like, yeah.
You couldn't use an axe for that.
Right, I mean, what? But most of the force entry tools that I saw had like a hook on them or an axe blade
I've
on one
I've seen those where,
yeah,
you sort of poke through a wall that's burnt on fire or something.
And you
okay.
could like pull it down and stuff. But anyway, I think that's what it's supposed to be, but it looks like a fucking towel rack.
Yes, it did. It looked like a curtain rod.
Yeah.
But so now they go at it for a little bit, and then Fazzle just bursts into this long series of fucking back handsprings all the way across the parking lot. Well, he's doing them. Then there's a shot of him running. Then a shot. Then more shots of him doing backflips.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the fuck is going on, editor?
He stopped and took a deep breath, and then he continued.
He lost momentum, and he was like, I got to get running again so I can do more backflips.
Where did his sword go? He didn't have his sword during any of this.
Yeah, I don't
know.
Did
he tuck it in the... in his sheath down his pants?
He threw it. He like sets it down. I don't know. But
it's
then
wild.
I like all the random B-roll shots of like lights flickering and Fazzle running through the garage, and I'm like, I don't understand. Like, these guys have both had each other on the ropes for ripe for a kill and did nothing.
Well, when I was watching, I was like, the guy who was doing the handsprings was not a good match.
No.
For Fazzle. So I'm like, wait, there's a third person here now, and he's doing backflips. I'm like, who the fuck is this? And then I realized it was supposed to be Fazzle, and I'm just like, oh, okay, I guess so. But it makes zero sense in the context of the story. So now McCloud, he gets his sword back. The fight goes on. McCloud knocks Fazzle's sword away and then lops his head off. It was kind of like surprisingly sudden to me.
Yeah.
As a first time viewer, I'm just like, holy shit, I didn't see that.
After everything that we had just seen, you would have thought it would have been more dramatic. But
it was like kind of anticlimactic in the end.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Or as anticlimactic as a beheading can be.
Yeah.
But then lots of blue lightning.
Yay!
Fazil's body starts levitating up off the ground. The blue lightning causes all the nearby cars. They start going fucking haywire, like headlights and oil.
It's not the blue lightning. Fassel's soul fucks every car in that parking garage.
Like, oh, fucked it?
Oh, yeah.
We should also mention that because it'll become important later, that when McCloud took the big swing with his katana that decapitated Fazzle, like he swung so hard that he lodged his blade in a pillar in
like
the parking garage
pillar,
and then had to struggle to get it out of the pillar.
Good shout, John. But yeah, all the a bright light is shining on McCloud now for some reason. I don't know if that was meant to be a headlights on one of the cars or something. And yeah, the cars just begin to flat out explode. Then we hear police sirens in the distance, which who fucking called the cops?
Yeah, like
they're here already. Who called the cops? Did someone walk in and see a sword fight?
Maybe because the sprinklers went off or something.
I assume the sprinklers are going off that might have triggered some sort of alarm.
Maybe.
It didn't evacuate Madison Square Garden, but wrestling was happening, so fine.
That's right. People were too enthralled by the Freebirds.
So McCloud gets up and he hides his katana up in some sort of an overhead contraption.
I think that's the
light.
I don't know what that was.
I
think that's the hanging, a hanging fluorescent light.
I've seen those in parking garages before. Okay.
I thought it was some kind of fixture or something too, but there was no bulb. I mean, it was dark.
It was just weird, but yeah. So
all the bulbs exploded when Basil Sola banged every electronic in the area.
That's true.
He doesn't take any notes, though, about where he saved it. It's on the floor with the pillar that has the graffiti that says Tommy.
Maybe he's like next to the blood stain, perhaps. Next to where is that? Next to the head. I don't know. But cut to medieval Scotland, where we see McCloud is being fated as they head off to battle. He's got this entourage. They're leaving their castle. Bagpipes are blasting. People are coming to see them off. There's this town crier that's cluing us in that the year is 1536. You see shit like this, and you realize how good the production value like on Braveheart is compared to
big time
other movies that are trying to do something epic on the cheap, you know? Like this part of like the battle that was happening earlier just feels like kind of small and cheap to me.
Definitely.
Whatever, but
it's not too bad though. It's not like a matte painting in a studio somewhere. It seems like they're on site.
It made me want to go to Scotland, man. This stuff. This was
shot in Glencoe where my sisters and my mom just went a few months back. And my sister said it was like one of the most beautiful places. Like Facebook regularly gives me pictures of Glencoe and I'm like, I want to die there. I want to be there now.
That's awesome. So McCloud and his two close friends, they're joking with each other. The one of the guys is what we mentioned earlier, James Cosmo.
I think they're supposed to be his cousins. They're all McClouds.
Yeah. They're all the clan McCloud.
Dougal and whatever the other guy's name. Yeah, Angus. Yeah.
Yeah. The other dude didn't know him from anything else. He kind of looked like a poor man's Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah.
And then this woman who's also a McCloud.
She's supposed to be his wife. This is his first wife.
Damn. Okay, that adds a whole layer of toxicity.
This is supposed to be Connor McCloud's first wife.
Okay, so she looked kind of tarted up. She had like her cleavage all out and sort of seemed to have like lipstick on. She seemed way too clean for the year 1536. But she's chasing after McCloud. She gives him some flowers and wishes for his safe return. The dudes have nothing but jokes about like McCloud banging his wife and all this. But now we're on a gloomy battlefield. The evil army arrives led by Kurgan. That's Clancy Brown.
Right.
What a fucking look he had.
Yeah, just like skull armor or whatever.
Yeah. So I don't feel like he's leading the army. I think he's shown for the rival clan and he's like,
He's like a mercenary.
He's a Hessian.
He's well aware that they're like the two clans are going to fight and the Kurgan is like, all right, I want to be here, but that guy's mine. Otherwise, you're going to lose this battle.
And his helmet is like the skull of some creature that's never existed on Earth. I don't know what that was supposed to be.
It looks to me like a facsimile of like a giant rodent or something with like plumage sticking out of the back of it.
No, he's not that old. I was trying to think like he is pretty old. Like is some sort of ice age, like one of those giant bears.
Saber-tooth tiger or something.
Oh, yeah, good call. Yeah.
I mean, from the opening monologue that Connor gives us, they've existed since the dawn of time, except not all of them.
Yeah, I guess they were like prehistoric men at that time.
Yeah.
The Ice Age sort of.
Well, we're going to get into more about like the Kurgan. who at this point, they just like refer to him as Kurgan.
Yeah.
But then we find out that he is a Kurgan.
He's not even the Kurgan. No, he's just a Kurgan.
He is an Kurgan.
He's the last of the Kurgans.
Yeah, and then I started thinking of like that the Kurgans exist in the same universe. Like they were like Gozer worshippers in ancient Sumeria.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And whatever the era was that Conan the Barbarian lived
in. Like, yes, exactly.
Yeah, this sort of era lost in time. Atlantis was a thing, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so we got this supernatural lightning and thunder that seems to have McCloud and his army spooked. The Kurgan tells the leader of the rival clan to remember our agreement that the one called Connor McCloud is mine. You know, he's for me and me alone. So the rival clan knows all the McClouds by name.
By name and picture. They have like a Facebook that they were flipping through ahead of time to be like, all right, this guy's McCloud. He's Connor. Yeah. His skills are blank, blank, and blank.
Yeah, they had cross-stitched wanted posters up in Castle Murdoch or whatever the fuck it was.
Which is like, there is so many questions. As we learn, like no one could kill him anyway, right?
Right.
I guess, could a random person lop a immortal's head off and the immortal would be dead?
I think so.
If they knew that's what you had to do?
I don't think it would result in like the quickening where they like absorb each other's powers. Maybe that just gets lost and redistributed, but that's never addressed.
Yeah, that's a good question. Is like, what happens to an immortal's quickening if they're killed by a regular person? I guess the universe just absorbs it, and that's that. No one gets that power.
Yeah. We can get to it a little bit later when it starts getting mentioned. I'm also curious just how Kurgan even knew that Connor McCloud existed or found.
Because sometimes
there's like a radar.
Sometimes an immortal has a radar. Sometimes, but only sometimes.
I've got some notes for later episodes that I spent way too much time on, like, the Highlander wiki.
Ooh, no, that's nice. Reading shit. I can't wait to talk about that shit.
But yeah,
they all know each other by name. Like, it's an odd, like, brotherhood.
It is. And it's unlikely you'd ever meet each other, or that you'd meet each other and both survive the encounter to meet again.
Which, fucking, the Kurgan, like, everybody's like, never mind, we'll meet later. See you later, buddy. It's like, why? Fucking kill these guys.
Yeah, they can't kill you.
They can't kill you? Oh my god, it's weird. Stupid.
But the rival clan, their leader yells out, death to the McClouds, charges, battle breaks out, no one's attacking McCloud. McCloud dismounts his horse, he just screams McCloud, and then he's like puzzled why no one will fight him. He's walking around aimlessly, just muttering like, McCloud, fight me, fight me.
All of his men are being hacked to pieces, and like no one's coming for him.
I was also just noticing Lambert's long hair, and I feel like it's real. I feel like he had long hair for Tarzan. I feel like he could have shot all these early scenes with real hair.
That makes sense because that'll be the first time that we'll mention that his hair length changes so many times throughout this movie that it's like the fuck is happening.
But it should change from when huge amounts of time are passing. But are you saying it's changing from scene to scene?
In the scenes where he has like in 1985, even from scene to scene, it's like his hair length changes and it's like it's longer in one scene. It's long
they
enough to be fully slicked
back. They probably
went
into some pickups and stuff, and the continuity of hair got fucked. But he's wandering around. There's this bizarre moment where the priest like slit some dude's throat.
I like that priest.
Yeah, warrior priest. Kurgan, he's fighting his way towards McCloud. Suddenly, Kurgan is right behind McCloud on his horse. You get startled, McCloud does, by this like fearsome sight of the Kurgan.
Right.
Kurgan hops off his horse, instantly stabs McCloud in the chest.
Just
or whatever, in the side.
He's not ready for battle.
Well, so we're supposed to gather from the conversation with him and both cousins Dougal and Angus earlier that this is his first battle, which means that
I think he's supposed to be 18 years old. McCloud is
38,
48, maybe
for real.
Anyway, though, why not? Why didn't he cut dude's head off? Just because the movie would be over?
He clearly outclassed, just cut the fuck, like cut his head off.
Yeah. He's standing there. He's savoring having stabbed McCloud. McCloud's friends see that he's in trouble. They run over and Kurgan's looming over McCloud, like ready to cut his head off, says the line, there can be only one. First occurrence of the famous line.
More supernatural lightning happening.
Yeah, you get a little mini quickening or whatever happening. McCloud's mates, they run over, tackle the Kurgan, who just screams out, another time, McCloud!
Yeah, I give up.
And,
Uncle,
and he's driven away. And I'm like, wait, how did he... Did they hack him up and think he was dead, maybe? And then I don't know what would have happened there. He could have dispatched those two with ease, I would think.
Like, he got tackled by three or four guys who would not have known that he was immortal, and then he could have killed
each of them.
That's why
I think they might have stabbed him in the chest, and then you just leave him where he lays and thinking he's dead. I don't know.
Could have killed the whole army, the Kurgan could have. Like,
yeah,
that would
surely
not have been a problem.
So McCloud, he's lying there gravely wounded on the battlefield. All right, cut back to 1985.
Mm-hmm.
McCloud, he's hauling ass through the Madison Square Garden parking garage.
A sweet little car.
The vintage Porsche.
Props to that stunt driver.
It was like the one that Charlie drove in Top Gun. And
yeah,
you know, that model, badass. It's a Porsche 356 Speedster. He reaches the exit. Police cars arrive from every direction simultaneously and block him in. who called these cops? Like, they just were there quick. But
yeah,
I guess
it must have been the fire alarm.
Credit
or something.
It to the fire alarm. They immediately take him into custody with guns drawn.
Yeah.
Now, if you were responding to a fire alarm, you would not just be first guy you see we're drawing guns.
Yeah, that's
him.
The thing. It's like no one knew anything about the violence happening in the garage.
Unless someone witnessed it and called, and like there's a sword fight going on.
But they would have had to run upstairs, get a hold of a guard or a payphone.
Yeah, he would have been long gone.
Or perhaps they assumed that he's some sort of arsonist the way he's tearing ass out of the parking lot and they got a fire
maybe
alarm.
Yeah. That's what I'm just wondering. Are they even aware that a crime has been committed? I don't know.
New York but cops McLeod, in the 80s, man.
Yeah, that's true.
McLeod gets out of his car. They grab him and start roughing him up, like, immediately. Slam him against the car.
One,
they're frisking him.
One featured asshole cop who is
Garfield.
Especially smarmy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, lots of excessive force here for what, at most, would have been, like, a call about some sword fighting. Or this guy's speeding in the parking garage.
Which, in the 80s in New York, is like, yeah, that's okay. Yeah, fine.
I mean, but there's, like, 40 police on site for this also, which seems like a job for like
cars.
Two cops.
Dozens and dozens of police officers out
Someone
there.
Hacked the steam pipe again. bring the SWAT team. Now, a cop takes the wallet out of McLeod's pocket. He identifies him as Mr. Nash.
Mm-hmm.
Says he wants to know where you're going in such a hurry. The cop yanks McLeod's arm to try to cuff him, and McLeod knocks the guy down. Like, that's instant death in 2022.
Yep.
Now, more cops, they pounce on McLeod, including one with a gun pressed to his temple.
That same asshole cop
that's
runs
Garfield.
Up and is like, I'm going to shoot you in the face.
Don't move, pal. Don't even breathe.
That's a good impersonation.
That dude was fucking savoring that role, too,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
All right, cut back to 1536. There's this long beauty shot of the castle and the moat in like silhouette. It's dawn or dusk.
Another
or
one
something.
Of those great transitions happened.
Yeah,
right
yeah.
Here too.
All the wipes forward and backwards through time, like where you sort of pan into an inanimate object and then you come out and you're in a different place is kind of cool.
So we should have like a strikes and good marks for the editor.
Yeah, I would say so far all the transitions have been good.
There's the priest, he's like performing last rites from a cloud. He seems to be at death's door.
Sweet
that
Mohawk
woman who
priest.
Was
yeah, that
yeah,
dude's awesome.
Pretty rad.
He had like shaved all the way around except for one like tall mm-hmm. strip in the front. I loved it.
Yep.
That tart woman who maybe is his wife,
mm-hmm.
she's wailing. The friends tell her to quiet down. He's a Highlander, by God, and the last sound he hears should not be a wailing woman.
Amen.
That's some good old-fashioned misogyny right
I'm
there.
I'm pretty sure there's bagpipes like blasting in the background, though.
Yeah.
So like,
yeah, the dude's right
to hear
outside,
the pipes.
Like, wailing a lament.
Well, it's like, wait, if that's his wife, you're telling the wife to shut her
shut
trap.
Shut up, bitch. Sorry.
But so back in 1985, it's fucking chaos in the parking garage. The police are working the murder scene. The fucking headless corpse is just laying there for the world to see. Now, we got Brenda Wyatt. She's like a forensics tech. She arrives as the sheet is being pulled over the body mm-hmm. of Fassel. She's pissed that she didn't get called earlier. She asks if they made an arrest, and they say no, but we're holding somebody named Nash for questioning. And for some reason, include the detail that he's an antiques dealer to the forensics person, because that's information she needs. Odd thing to mention. One of the homicide detectives tries to flirt with Brenda. Total fucking creep. Hey, you look really pretty tonight or something shit like
John
that.
That's John Polito, who I most remembered as Bigelow, the guy that owned the airstrip in The Rocketeer.
Ooh.
But he was also Defino, the private investigator who was in the Volkswagen Beetle, who's like staking out. He was watching Lebowski and Big Lebowski.
Oh.
And he's like, what he calls himself, I'm an old shaman, or I can't even remember what Seamus or something like that. And he's like, what? So, yeah, so that
awesome.
Dude, like very recognizable look. Definitely.
He's just open sexual harassment of his coworker here. Now, the beat cop, the one who put the gun to McLeod's head, he tries cracking a joke with the lieutenant who's shown up, who's in charge, like he isn't in a laughing mood. The citizens are all fucking pissed off because they're not allowed to leave. They're not allowed to get to their cars. Brenda, she starts looking around the scene for some forensic evidence, I guess. Seems to find something.
Instantly.
Yeah.
Instantly.
The homicide detectives, they're over there discussing, you know, there was another beheading just like this recently in New Jersey.
You don't say. I like that. Yeah,
the lieutenant just dismissed it.
Frank.
Like,
Frank,
that's Jersey.
That dude's name is Frank, and he's like, well, yeah, that's Jersey, so I didn't think anything about it.
Yeah, that's normal.
So Brenda calls that lieutenant over. he seems to trip over the corpse, right?
Or slip on the blood or something. It's pretty funny. It's like Shaun of the Dead.
He's fucking up the scene here. Brenda has found Faziel's gilded sword under a car. Says it's a rare Toledo Salamanca sword worth about $1 million.
Wait.
Huh?
That's, yeah. She's very knowledgeable for a forensics tech. We find out later what's going on here a little bit, but I tried to research even that's not even like a real thing at Toledo Salamanca. I was like, oh, that must be a, like a,
it's some sort of like, if you've watched Toledo's the movie, a type broadsword, of metal,
maybe.
Yeah. But it looks like the broadswords that Tim Roth and yeah. Liam Neeson.
It looks like the shit you've seen in
Rob Roy
and in Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Like that they're dueling with and stuff. These just very ornate. Sort of fencing.
Well, that's
swords.
Even like a rapier. Like this thing would have been like bigger, stronger, thicker steel. But I mean, it's like how the fuck these cops missed it lying here right
it's
under
like
a car.
Glittering
it's
and
right
gold.
She just walked past the body like 10 steps and was like, oh fuck, there's a huge sword over here. I wonder if this is involved.
So
nah,
Brenda,
that's just a parking garage sword. Put it back.
Yeah.
Brenda makes the connection that, you know, an antique dealer might have access to a sword like this.
Aha.
Brainwave.
That would have been the time to call out that, oh, well, our guy Nash was is an antique.
It's like, say it's an antique sword. Oh, the Nash is an antique. You could have written this movie so much better in your sleep.
Yep.
But that's where we're going to leave you for this week.
But there's so much more to talk about.
We've only done one.
We're just getting started here.
And there have to be five.
Damn. Yes,
there can only be five. But we will be back next week with a whole lot more excitement. So thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Andrew, for being here.
Yes, Andrew. I know you're going to continue on this journey with us. You're our shaman. We need you.
Hell yeah. I'm your Ramirez.
That's right. Oh, thank God.
All right. We'll be back.